This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Mountjoy House in the Phoenix Park still is the home of the Ordnance Survey. It all started back in the 19th century with Colby, Larkham, O'Donovan and friends. Now in the 21st century, the home is more or less the same as it was back in the 19th century, but the names have changed just a little bit. Richard Kerwin is the Chief Executive Officer of today's Ordnance Survey. And you're a very lucky man, Richard, to be working in such a beautiful place as the Phoenix Park. They chose well back in the 19th century.
So certainly 19th century, they had an eye to beauty. The Phoenix Park is probably one of the most wonderful settings for anyone to work in these days, or indeed then. And even despite the traffic of the 21st century, the Phoenix Park retains all its charm. And the offices at the Phoenix Park, again, even though they haven't changed visually since that time, or very little, it is a great place to work in.
Yeah. Now, the story of the Ordnance Survey itself, we say that the building hasn't changed that much. We acknowledge that the staff has changed just a little bit since the 1800s. That's to be expected, I suppose. The legacy that you were left in terms of maps, Richard, how good was it?
When the Irish state was set up in 1922, and obviously Ordnance Survey became part of the civil service of the day, the legacy that was left to us in terms of mapping was probably one of the best legacies left to the state, in that the mapping was recognised that time as being probably the best in the world. The mapping itself had, particularly the rural areas, had just the resurvey of that had just been completed. So we were left with a fully up-to-date mapping system.
And that survey and that system that was there in the 1920s, how long did it last before something new had to be done?
That survey effectively lasted until the middle of the 1960s. It was so good then, and there was so little change in Ireland, that it was felt that there was no need to do any radical update on maps between then and the 1960s. But obviously then in the 1960s, and indeed maybe the late 1950s, the urban landscape began to change. And we had the beginning of the urban development and urban sprawl for housing and business. And at that stage, it was recognised that the mapping was no longer adequate for what was required.
When Colby and his colleagues started their survey back in the 19th century, the first thing that they did was to take a primary triangulation of the country. Was that the first step that you had to take in the 1960s as well?
When we decided to resurvey in the 1960s, and indeed slightly before that in the 50s, it was recognised that we needed a new triangulation or framework for the country on which to base the mapping.
The triangulation that they did caused them physical hardship. They had this enormous theodolite to cart up the sides of hills. They had to stay up there for weeks on end, months on end sometimes. Was it different in the 1960s?
I would say that the 1960s was probably just as difficult. In the early days, they didn't, for instance, erect pillars on mountains.
Yes, because we have a picture here. This is John Danaher, who is a former employee of the Ordnance Survey, now retired. And this is taken sometime in the late 50s, possibly early 60s. And John is strapped, tied with a big rope, to a large concrete pillar. The pillar's about 5 foot tall. And on the top of that pillar is a reasonably small theodolite, possibly about 12 to 18 inches tall. Why has John got himself tied in here?
Well, that's a photograph of a pillar on Mount Errigal. And the retriangulation had to be carried out at night time, first of all, because obviously they had to measure angles between mountains, and the only way they could effectively see from one mountain to another was using lights, and they needed darkness for that. But it had to be carried out effectively whenever the opportunity arose. And whether the winds were high or low, John had to be there and his colleagues had to be there. And for safety reasons, so that he wouldn't effectively be blown off the pillar, John had to strap himself. And, you know, interestingly enough, the pillar itself that was on Errigal has since been blown down since the 1960s. So it gives you some indication of the strength of the winds and the hardship that the people at the time had to undergo.
The picture that John is in has a small theodolite on the top of the pillar. This second picture from about the same period has another three gentlemen, employees, I presume, of the Ordnance Survey, with a very large instrument beside the pillar and another, how would I describe it, a series of metal triangles on a pole behind it.
They were targets, and where you could see from one mountain to the other without the aid of a light, these targets were very often used because obviously you could work by daytime. But it did mean that people were carting these things up and down mountains, either themselves or if they were fortunate enough to be able to hire a horse from a farmer, they could go, bring it up on the horse.
Which probably wasn't that much different from the 19th century.
I would say it was probably as difficult. The only thing I think that they didn't have to do was to assemble the theodolite on top of the mountains, because in the 19th century they had to physically put the theodolite together. They didn't in modern times. But to counterbalance that, they had to cart sand and cement and shuttering and other equipment up the mountains to construct the pillar.
Being up the side of a mountain also involves coming back down. And there are stories of inventive employees of the Ordnance Survey who thought they had a way of making sure they wouldn't get lost.
Yes, it wasn't an easy thing going up mountains, and particularly where you had humped-backed mountains and you couldn't effectively see the top of the mountain. And one of the true stories told was that one particular individual had difficulty in knowing where he was going on Kilka Mountain. And in order to overcome the difficulty, he decided he would buy a ball of thread in the local shop, and that he would extend the thread from the Land Rover to the top of the mountain, which obviously was quite a brilliant idea. The only downside was that when he was coming back from the mountain, having successfully gone up the mountain with the thread, he didn't realise that the sheep on the mountains could in fact walk through the thread, and thereby, as he followed the thread and thought he was coming towards the van, he actually ended up probably five kilometres away from the van.
After that primary triangulation in the 1960s, Richard, there was a commission set up that decided that a revision of mapping was needed in Ireland.
Yes, there was a review body set up, which was effectively an internal review body, to look at the needs for mapping going forward. The results, or the main results of that review body, were A, that the urban mapping, which was by now very much out of date, should be completely resurveyed and new mapping created, and B, that the rural mapping should be updated. And the first element of that was obviously the urban mapping. Now, fortunately, at that time, technology was beginning to move on. And instead of the surveyors having literally to go onto the field and do 100% ground survey, the aerial survey techniques had been introduced. Ordnance Survey purchased its first aerial machine around 1965.
We're looking now at two pictures of Gort in County Galway, black and white pictures from that period. But they do give a very good overall impression of the lie of the land. In one of the pictures, however, Gort is very much at the edge of it, on the very western edge. And in the second picture, it's right in the centre of the photograph. What is that double taking about?
Well, I suppose the amazing thing about these air survey machines is that they enabled one to recreate the three-dimensional view that you would normally see as you move through the country. And using the technique of using what we call two overlapping photographs, whereby one photograph of a particular area, Gort in this case, was taken from one direction, from an aircraft, and the aircraft then moved on and took a photograph from another direction. Using those two photographs in the machine and a series of prisms and mechanical wheels and so on, the operator could literally see a three-dimensional view of the ground.
So the aerial team, having taken a series of photographs, and in this case the two photographs of Gort avoiding an overlap so that they had the entire area covered, they brought those back to base here in the Phoenix Park. And this picture now that we're looking at She was a very peculiar looking machine. Looks in some ways like a printing press. This was a mechanical way of changing the aerial photograph into a map.
Yes, the aerial photographs were placed in those machines, and using a set of prisms, the operator, through eyepieces, which you can see here, could physically see the photographs as three-dimensional models. He then, using these series of wheels, which we can see here, would move a dot, which he had in the eyepiece, along, for instance, the roads and the houses, plotting the roads and the houses, and that translated mechanically into the plotting machine that we're looking at now. So the end result was a map drawn from the aerial photograph, which was true to scale.
So the aerial photograph was processed in a certain way through this stereo plotter, and a map was drawn from that. Was that the finished product? Was that perfectly usable?
No, using the stereo plotters, you could pick up about 80% of the detail. And really, you could obviously not see under trees, shadow, obviously obliterated detail. So the surveyor then went onto the ground and completed the map. That map then came back to the Phoenix Park, and it had to be, as we called it, fair drawn. In other words, we had to get a high quality drawing for the user. And again here, technology had moved on, because in the older times, maps were drawn on paper.
So this map that we're looking at now, which is of part of County Limerick, is not drawn on paper. It's on plastic. Why is that?
Paper was notoriously unstable. And given any climate change, any humidity change, paper would distort. The important thing now was to try and hold stability. And the plastic we used was very, very stable and was almost indifferent to climate changes.
This urban revision then gave us a new series of maps, and we're looking now at a map of Navan, first of all from 1910, and this second map, which would be post-revision, from 1969. Some of the differences that I look at immediately are name changes. For example, the agricultural showground on the early map has now become Park Talton. And beside that, just across from that, there's a hospital which has changed name as well, Richard.
Yes, that was originally the Union Workhouse, and it has now become Our Lady's Hospital. And indeed, you can see the expansion that had taken place around that time, or possibly shortly before that. But I suppose the most notable changes on the map itself are the development of the housing estates on the outskirts of what was then Navan. For instance, we have Parnell Park on to the south of the railway. To the north of that, we have Emma Terrace and O'Growney Terrace. Then in the 1970s, when the urban mapping remapping was underway, it was decided that the rural mapping itself should be updated. And that entailed moving away from what was known as the county series maps to a national grid-based system. One of the things about the county series maps was that every single county had been surveyed as an entity in the past. So there was no real connection between the coordinates of one county and another.
And also, as well as that, changing over to the national grid, a new revision involved heading back out into the field again. Are we back to the days of the 19th century and camping out overnight?
We were back, certainly, to the triangulation. Probably not as difficult in that we didn't have to climb as many mountains, but certainly encountered the human difficulties. In many instances, a bottle of whiskey could probably resolve a lot of the issues, but one in particular that the whiskey didn't work on was one I was involved in myself in West Cork in Kerry, when we had to coordinate a point on a mountain. And in order to do that, we had to build a pillar, as I described earlier. Normally, we'd go to the farmers, the local farmers, and ask who owned a mountain, and invariably it was common age, so it was easy to get to. But in this particular instance, the farmer assured us he owned the mountain. We then did a deal with him to use his horse and indeed himself to bring cement and sand up the mountain. We had all the supplies up the mountain, and we were going back the next week to physically build the pillar. And I wasn't there myself just for that particular one. But the team were going up the mountain, And again, it was one of these humped-backed mountains that where they couldn't see the top. But as they moved up, ranging rods that they had placed on the side of the mountain so that they could see where they were going were broken. And they wondered, was this vandalism? Was it kids messing or whatever? But as they approached the top of the mountain, they saw three gentlemen with what appeared to be guns. And as they got nearer, they found, yes, they were guns. So they were a little apprehensive. These gentlemen then introduced themselves, or certainly two of them did, as clergymen. And they were told, in no uncertain terms, that they were trespassing, that the mountain belonged to one of the clergyman's families, and that we should get off the mountain. They looked for the boss, and they were told I wasn't there, so I was summoned to the local hotel that night time to explain myself. The clergyman didn't turn up, but the next day we went to his family's house and explained the position. And really, I think the issue was not about whether we got up the mountain or not, but how much we had paid the other farmer to bring the material up. So at the end of the day, I think we may have brought a second load of material up, and that resolved the problem.
And there was no whisky involved?
Being clergy, I think we had to stay away from the whisky.
And technology now started to play a greater part. And this is at a period, if we've got to think of things like James Bond movies, where computers filled whole rooms. Yeah. And there's an instrument here called the telerometer, which to me sounds as if it's straight out of a James Bond movie. What was it for? What did it do?
Yeah, this, again, was a major advance in technology, in that in the early triangulation, the only thing people could do was measure angles and measure distance using tapes. The telerometer was a radio-based piece of equipment, about the size of two car batteries. So you can imagine the sort of size was like a black box with lots of dials, lots of buttons, lots of knobs on it. And it sent signals between two instruments, between two telerometers, to measure distances between points.
Using sound waves to do that.
Yeah, using radio waves effectively to do that. And then depending on as we call it, the phase differences, we could measure the physical distance between points.
The wonderfully named telerometer and all of those big and bulky machines that were around in the 60s and 70s were mechanical machines, Richard, and they became defunct very quickly.
What happened in the 1980s and then moving on to the 1990s is that the technology changed absolutely rapidly. We moved into what we called digital mapping. The bulky machinery of the air survey and that sort of mechanical machinery, that again became defunct, and computerized machinery moved in, which enabled us to do a lot more in-house with the aerial photography and the machinery. The result of that was that by the early 1990s, we again reviewed the methodology by which we were revising the rural mapping and the speed at which we were revising those. And we decided that it would be far better, both from an economic point of view and also from the looking forward to the benefit that the customers would get in the future, to abandon the older mapping, the older rural mapping that was started in the 1930s, that we began to revise in the 1970s, and to resurvey from scratch using aerial photography and using the modern technology of aerial survey methods to produce a brand new mapping series.
And the techniques in the field, how had those changed in the intervening period?
Well, they changed dramatically in the very early 1990s, in that we had, I think, around 1990, about 120, 130 people employed directly on field duties. And because the technology was changing so rapidly, it was more economic to use aerial survey methods. We actually reduced the number of people on the field from that 130 people down to less than 20 people. And most of the work was carried out then in the offices using aerial photography.
And computer technology.
And, of course, computer technology. And everything we captured was what we call digitized or computerized. Those old photographs we looked at earlier on of air survey machines with mechanical plotting, they disappeared totally. And we just we ended up with screens, with the aerial photographs shown on the screens. And they were automatically, the detail was automatically recorded via the computer.
That survey then in the 1990s, Richard, really shows us the face of a changing Ireland. And that change is most visible in the places where the urban meets the rural. For example, this map that we're looking at right now from the 1950s around the area of Athlone, around the townland of Kilmacooch, is absolutely rural and bogland. There's no housing development or very little housing development shown on this map.
Absolutely none. There's the odd house along the roadways. You can see the bogs there. But that map is probably as it was in the 1920s with a very small update on it. Well, then if we look at the second map, which was resurveyed in the 2000 to 2004 area, we can see here in the northwestern part of the map, again in Kilmacooch, the huge urban development that has taken place, places like Willow Park Place, all housing development.
And up above that, at around the townland of Garry Castle, it looks as if it's industrial development. I see industrial estate written beside it, but we have a way of being absolutely certain that it is industrial development.
Yeah, if we look at the enlarged aerial photograph, we can see very, very clearly that, yes, it is an industrial development here in the centre of the map and towards the northwest of the map. But the other thing that is interesting about the photograph, and indeed photographs generally, is the additional information that can be gleaned from them. And if we look to the southwest of this photograph, and indeed the southwest of the map, the map itself just showed bogland, but the photograph clearly indicates that there is harvesting of turf in the area, and it gives a very, very clear view of all of the activities and the usage of the land.
And another thing that's very clear on the aerial photograph version of the map is the recently built Athlone Bypass.
Yes, you can see that very, very clearly. And anyone who travels that road from Dublin to Athlone, or indeed Dublin to Galway, will be very, very familiar with the roundabout at the beginning of the Athlone bypass on the Dublin side of Athlone.
And the services just beside it, which are crystal clear in this photograph.
Exactly. Services, I suppose, we've all availed of ourselves from time to time. But they show very, very clearly the services, the cars, the pathways in and around the buildings.
In the 1990s as well, Richard, there was a change in terms of tourist maps, we might call them, or indeed, looking at this map here that I have in front of me of South Donegal, I'm tempted to call it a leaving certificate map.
Yes, the traditional tourist map was the half-inch map, and I think any of us that did the Leaving Cert more than 10 years ago will remember the half-inch map from their geography days. That map dated from about the 1913 or thereabouts, and again it was dated, it needed to be upgraded. And in the late 1980s, we began to produce what was then known as the 1 to 50,000 series.
And the final version is now published in what's called the Discovery Series.
The final version is the Discovery Series, and here we see a map of County Clare. And again, the interesting thing about this Discovery Series is that where it has updated detail, it has a lot more information on contours, towns and so on. But the look and feel of this map is broadly similar to the original 1-inch and half-inch maps that were produced in the early part of the century.
At one time, to have all the 6-inch maps of Ireland, you would have needed space to store 20,000 sheets. To have the 25-inch maps, you would have needed space to store another 32,000 sheets or thereabouts. What sort of space would you need today to have all of the maps that the Ordnance Survey produce?
Well, all of the maps, as you know, are produced in computer form. We can produce all of those maps on about 40 CDs.
And in terms of surveying itself and map making, has technology taken over and is the human now almost defunct?
Certainly technology is a key element. But at the end of the day, we will continue to rely on the tape for fine measurements, and we will continue to rely on the judgment and the skill and the eye of the surveyor to produce that final document, which allows us to get a true picture of the lie of the land.